My name is Clarissa Cummings, and I'm the founder of Urban National. Urban National is an organization, and we look to support the leadership development of Black changemakers working in urban spaces and starting innovative movements in our cities.
So where are you from, and where did your passion about giving folks a platform grow out of?
Yeah, so I am a rare breed. I'm actually a unicorn. I'm a third-generation Brooklynite, and that's third-generation by tracking on my maternal side and my paternal side. We go back in New York. I can't even trace back in the family Bible. So I'm hardcore Brooklyn here, and even hardcore New Yorker. So from Brooklyn, it really means a lot to me. Growing up there in the city has absolutely fueled kind of where I stand today, my vision, what I look at, what I'm passionate about. So I think it all really began with Urban National. I'd say when I went to grad school for international affairs. I worked in entertainment for 10 years. And I just knew, you know, I had been traveling around a lot, just was getting some really innovative ideas about political movements that were happening in Black spaces globally. So I'm going to all these cities, and it's just like amazing things happening. But one of the things that really struck me was that no matter where I went, all around the world, the same song. Like, if you thought we were complaining in Brooklyn about gentrification and about Black flight and rising prices in homes and so forth, man, they're talking about the same thing over in from South Africa to the Caribbean. It is the same story. So I was just like, wow, there's a real thread running through issues and crises that come out of the cities, and more specifically marginalized communities, more specifically Black communities. But what I found out in working in some of the development work that I was doing was I would just always ask the question, I'm just like, what is it going to take to make this work, right? You know, so I'm going in places, I'm seeing infrastructure, and like you're talking about places that for 15 years will still be talking about how to get running water into their apartments, you know? So I just wondered, how are we still surviving? How are these communities still thriving? You know, innovation still coming out of it? And so what I noticed that the thread in all these communities was that the people in a community were working together. All of these informal practices were happening to keep the community running, and running in very creative ways, you know? So they would often overlook the government, overlook the systems that were supposed to provide and said, you know, through government, we will, you know, you have a right to this, it's your human right, and then just sitting around looking and you can't have food and you can't have water, you don't have, you know, proper structures around you to live. And so yet people are thriving. How does that happen? Is really your neighbor? Is really the other people in the community? Is really them building structures? So I became very interested in that informal type of community. It's a community that I came out of. My paternal grandparents were out of Vanderveer housing projects, and my maternal grandparents were also the first in their apartments in the Gowanus housing projects. And so it was a real interesting community, just Black folks varied from all walks of life, just a community full of people, just we're trying to survive, everyone's trying to do the best they can. And I just remember certain figures, including my grandfather, and the little things that they did in the community to keep us thriving. And I always remember my grandfather, who was in Vanderveer. I don't know if you remember, in some of the housing complex where there's lawns and grass, there are like chain fences around them. And so the post of them, the top of the post would, you can screw off. And so kids or whatever, people screw them off, and then it gets filled with water from the rain, and people would stuff junk and stuff down. And my grandfather then would say, hey, you know, tell the local kids, if you find those tops around the neighborhood, bring them back to me. I'll give you $1 for each one, right? So like little things like that. I mean, you know, activism is seeing a problem that you want to change and taking the active steps to make that happen. And that is happening every day in Black communities and in spaces that I grew up with. Urban National is founded to recognize that type of activism that's going on, to support it, to provide some professional development. We do workshops. We also have provided open space areas to provide change makers areas to work, and anything that we always have our ear to the streets. What do you need? You know, what do you need? What can we provide you with? And then we build community.
I think this is a great space to transition into community responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking a lot about that, especially at the end of the decade. I've been in a very reflective space just about like my life, the things that I'm doing and building and also doing in community. But I'm like, what is community responsibility beyond voting? Because some people have it like, you know, I went to go vote and like I did my due diligence. And so just from your perspective and also thinking about Urban National mm-hmm. and what you're building as a community, how do you see community responsibility? And also thinking about acknowledged activism versus unacknowledged activism, because I know that's one of the models for Urban National.
Mm-hmm. So I would actually put this community building synonymous and, or rather underneath the umbrella of activism as well. Here's what we do every day and what we see. There are ways in which we are community building and people don't acknowledge it. Even the people who are doing it don't realize that they're doing it. I'll give you an example. It's a good example. If, let's say, you're in a community with a high or high rise in HIV rate. If you are a person who's in a group that is considered targeted for HIV rates, and you continuously go to get checked, and you continuously protect yourself, and you make sure you do not contribute, you do everything it takes for you as a, your personal self not to contribute to this epidemic, is that not an act of activism? Is that not community building? I think it is. You know, it's responsibility. It's saying there is an issue in this community and it's problematic, and I'm gonna do A, B, or C to get it done. So I think when it comes to community building, especially in the spaces that I work in, that's how the activism tends to look like. I'll give you another example, which another bit of overlooked activism, I think, happening in our communities, tenant associations. Listen, I grew up in tenements. People love a good tenant association, and some radical work gets done, and it's filled with single mothers, it's filled with fathers, it's filled with, you know, young people with, you know, sometimes no higher education. It's filled with some, it's just a space for people really to build on and act upon change and trying to provide that change. So I think there are ways and avenues where you see a lot of community building, right? A lot of community responsibility happening, but we just don't call it that, right? As well, I do feel, I mean, I know we tend to hear certain language and certain stories like that are prevalent that's supposedly coming out of a community, which I think are absolute falsehoods, such as, you know, not placing importance on education. I think that's crap. I hear that a lot. As well as not being active in issues that, you know, matter to you. Or thinking about ways that you give back, that people see you, that you are still involved in a community, even if your body has moved out of the space, you know. So to community building, community relations, activism, one, I say that it is happening. It's happening in a big way. And I think we just need to acknowledge it more as well, and also provide resources for what's happening. I'll give you another example that a lot of times when things have to happen in certain communities, like you think about funding and the way it goes on, that money is coming what I call hand to pocket. You know, you call up your neighbor, you call up your family, hey, the team, you know, we're trying to build this football team. They need to go to practice or need uniforms. Who can provide $5 for that? And those things were happening all the time, okay? But again, I don't think that people recognize or acknowledge certain work or certain activities as, you know, underneath the umbrella of activism or community building.
You have here on this this diagram white dominant culture.
Oh, yeah.
And so in thinking about some of my nonprofit experiences, particularly, you know, the last nonprofit that I was with, it's easy for funders to throw money at a shiny thing. And most times, the shiny thing is a result of the folks who are on the ground who more times have those relationships where those organizations seek out those people to like have that work. So I'm interested in thinking about acknowledged activism and unacknowledged activism as you frame it. What can funders do better? Like, what can they be more intentional about when it comes to the types of projects and initiatives that they're funding?
Yeah.
If you can give some insight to, like, some of the things, like, if we're thinking about rubrics, like, what should funders be looking for? Because what I've found, especially now, you know, just transitioning here to WBGO, North Public Radio, is just how important it is to like have relationships with funders. They want to know the work that's happening and what's happening on the ground, but there's still this disconnect.
Okay, but that is loaded. Let's get started. Okay, it's a few things that we're working out, right? Okay, so I'll start with Urban National, right? So just to let you know, this to be a 501c3, to be a nonprofit or not to be a nonprofit is one of the number one discussions I have amongst Black change makers and the leaders that I work with. That should I, shouldn't I, is a tug and pull that sometimes I've seen organizations go on for at least a couple of years trying to figure this out. I'll bring in Urban National and what I've decided. I knew from the beginning I could not make Urban National a nonprofit, okay? As soon as I said, listen, I need real impact here. I need real, and let me also say, Britt, let me back up. I work in nonprofit. Matter of fact, I've worked, most of my career has been in nonprofit, okay? So once I said Urban National needs to do real work, and that stuff that's just written down on data or sheets or glossy paper at the end of the year to show the funders. Once I made that decision, I knew I could not be a 501c3. I just knew it. Because you know what I'm gonna have to do? If I, let's say, put off a programming, and let's say for whatever reason, let's say I'm piloting it, and let's just say, like, you know, I do my best, you put it out there, so maybe something didn't work, right? So I have to work it out a bit. I have to come back. I have to, you know, there's nothing wrong with you're testing something out, working it out. You don't have the ability to do that when you're a 501c3. I got to only show you success, okay? And if I don't show you success, then I'm not going to get your money, right? And then all of my livelihood is built on me telling you that there are successes when the truth is that this work is ongoing, right? The truth is when I talk to leaders, I sometimes tell them, listen, if you're talking about a specific issue, are you comfortable with knowing that you just might go to your grave not seeing the impact as you want? It might happen after you. How comfortable are you? And that's real, right? I can't be real to my community underneath the guise of this government work that is telling me I need to show them a certain amount of money. My survival depends on your funding. And so then what are you going to do? You're going to lie. And I'm not lying. So, you know, you're going to have to fudge numbers. Everyone's then becoming more concerned about numbers and pictures with children than, hey, did this work? Did this work? Right? So I'll start with that, right? So I knew from the beginning we would not be a 501c3. However, that whole nonprofit industrial complex, which I just explained to you, just kind of being, is part of this, the world of activism, the world of social change. And it is something that I'm always thinking through, and I'm working with other change makers. We're always thinking through to think about what's a new model that we can use where social justice is sustainable upon itself, right? So we're always discussing this. But what it leads to, this nonprofit industrial complex, it leads to this idea of what activism looks like and who gets to say, hey, I'm activism and I'm doing this work, right? And a lot of it comes down to who is legitimized by the government, who has this 501c3 behind their name, who can tout that. And I'm calling that there's a problem with that, because what happens is that there becomes marginalization within the social justice community. So there becomes activism, which I call is above the radar. That activism I call acknowledged activism. That type of activism, first and foremost, always comes through the legitimized, certifications, paperwork, whether it's degrees. You know, a lot of these people in social justice spaces have degrees from Berkeley, have 4 years, you know, and that's not a criticism, but it's how you legitimize this work, right? So higher education, your degrees, 501c3, all these government paperworks. So you have to be legitimized through this type of certification. That's the first step in this type of acknowledged activism. Then you move on and, you know, you get the recognition and the affection when you are like these organizations doing, like, you know, supposedly have great missions, right? They sound good. You're helping these people and so forth. But they also come to the table with a certain type of network, right? And a network that comes out of certain privileges. You might have been in school. Like, again, you need money, right? Who do you go to fund it to? Maybe your network that came out of college, and those people might have different types of resources. You just have more accessibility to these resources. You have more accessibility to, like, branding and marketing and articles. And even something that I think is overlooked is who gets to march. Like, you have to fill out paperwork. You have to fill out a permit. Like, I mean, that sounds like a no-brainer for, I think, people who have been doing this work or kind of have, again, some resources, some education behind them. But there are a lot of people without their resources. Who's going to fill out these government papers, especially in communities which are suspicious of the government? And, you know, I used to hear growing up a lot, nobody but my business. I don't want you my business. Don't, you know, some of this comes out of our community. Why am I going to have you sign in government papers? And then lastly, you know, I think what results from this type of activism, the acknowledged activists then go on to create the language of activism and social justice. They set the standards. They tell you what the protocol should be, how meetings should look, how facilitation should be done, how you should talk to young kids and so forth. They get to set everything. One examples I use with that is, I hear this a lot, when I hear facilitators, you know, wanting to go into marginalized communities, especially when it's youth, and it's like, oh, let's build breathing techniques, you know, and they want to start things with these type of techniques like meditation or like things that they want to introduce. And I'm not criticizing that at all, but what I am saying is how much acknowledgement are you giving to who your audience is? So, for instance, if I'm coming from out of a community where noise and chaos, I might be more comfortable with that. You know, quiet might unnerve me a bit. If I'm from a community and it's, you know, loud families or just, you know, my community is just really quiet, how would I introduce meditation to that? It's different. But again, certain people get to dictate what works and what is considered the right thing to do.
You just got me thinking. I keep representing this last nonprofit experience I had because it was absurd. It was wild. I felt like I was on a sitcom. Mm. And it was just so spot on what you were saying, and it resonated with me because these were folks, most of them Ivy League.
Mm-hmm.
And then the folks who recruited me to work here in Newark who were from Brooklynites. Mm-hmm. I'm an honorary Brooklynite
because of them.
I'm an honorary Brooklynite because of them. So, you know, these were folks who were coming to this youth work having 10 years, 20 years, some of them 30 years under their belt.
Mm-hmm.
But here is these young Ivy League folks who are now positioned as the experts, right? And sometimes I felt like their work was diminished, their expertise was diminished. Sometimes I felt like my expertise and my cultural context of where I come from and the relationships I've built just having lived here was also taken for granted, but also taken advantage of. And I think that this is just such a timely conversation to also be thinking about, like, what are the structures that we're saying yes to?
Exactly. How about if I propose something else where we try to just don't consider the funders? How about if I said, like, scrap that model and let's figure out something else that is a little, I mean, this is, again, we're talking this out, let's figure it out.
I mean, I love that. You know, that's something that I've been actively thinking about after leaving that last nonprofit experience, because I'm like, wow, you could really curate something that actually isn't what you're saying that it is.
Mm-hmm.
And just like how we feel as folks in these communities when we say yes in hope, right? Mm-hmm. In possibility. And it's like, wow, mm-hmm. here we are again on our back, right? Mm-hmm. Here it is. You give this organization millions of dollars and not even think mm-hmm. twice to like invest that money into something that's actually already sustainable.
Absolutely.
Into organizations that have already been doing this work. And it brings me to a question that I jotted down, like, you have here under your diagram for unacknowledged activism, no seat at the table, mm-hmm. but it's, do we need a seat at the table?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm.
do we need a seat at the table? Mm-hmm. Should we be thinking about and actively creating our own models to say, this is how we're gonna do our work?
And my answer would be, I mean, absolutely have to talk about it, but then I also think, because I'm working with so many change makers, like, okay, but what do we do in the meantime? Right? What do we do in the meantime? And I'm telling you, I have a lot of sympathy for these organizations. Like, you want to do the work, but you can't do the work to a certain capacity without a certain type of funding, right? And so this, like, I just see them straining themselves, forced, like they are, and they go into this, you know, nonprofit plan just begrudgingly and trying their best. And yes, so the answer, I would say the answer is still on. We're still figuring it out,
for sure.
Right? We're still figuring it out. We need to try some things, work it out. And also, I believe that there is a better connection that can happen. I think there's something happening along the corporate social responsibility area. I see some good things happening, right? And so what I would say, and let me just back up with that. A lot of corporations, too, let's not forget what you get, the benefits you get when you're dealing with 501c3s, right? So, you know, corporations in some ways are part of this system where it's like, hey, you know, I have to get a tax benefit. So I can't give my funding to Urban National. What can they give me back for my taxes? That won't work, you know. I'll also say something interesting that I see a lot now in the communities is that there'll be a lot of leaders who are maybe in positions like me where you have to use your own funding, right? So then what happens, Britt? You then start, the leaders start to look a certain way. For instance, just a lot of people, and I'll put myself out there too, right? You know, I can have some without family, I'm not married, without, you know, a lot of that income can then go towards Urban. I can afford that, right? So then your leaders start to look like the people who can kind of self-fund, or if they're saying, listen, I'm not going to nonprofit, I have to do this. So you will see a lot of, you know, maybe middle-class single women, I would say. I'm starting to see that kind of spread out. And so I really want us to be conscious of this and make sure that, you know, a range of people can have this opportunity. So sometimes a lot of times I'm seeking out young males out of the community. And so again, a lot of them are doing the work. They're just not calling it. They're just not calling it what it is. They don't know to call it that.
I think that this is a great segue into the offerings of Urban National, mm-hmm. particularly, you know, the dinners that you've been hosting. Mm-hmm. So can you give us an idea of, like, how that came to be?
Sure.
And also, like, some of the projects or byproducts of you just bringing folks together who really care about their communities Absolutely. And are innovating to create more access for the people in their communities.
Absolutely. Urban National really officially launched last year, and we knew that it would take a couple of years to like build up this network. So how do we do it? Again, we have programming. We have some great programming. You know, a lot of one-offs. Like I said, we had offered open workspace to change makers. We had a great film screening and panel discussion with the director, Kurt Ortison, with Not In My Neighborhood, a look at gentrification in Brooklyn, Sao Paulo, and Cape Town. We've had, it was fantastic. So we have definitely community events such as that. But I think really our Baker and Supper series is what is going to be key to building this collaborative, dynamic network of Black change makers in every city all over the world. That's what I see, right? Us being able to call on each other, whether you're here in Detroit or in Nairobi, okay? So the Baker and Supper series, it's founded based on the spirit of Ella Baker, who's a civil rights activist. Ella Baker is a civil rights activist, a former head of NAACP, New York City chapter. I mean, just dynamic woman. And Ella Baker is important because she was a unique type of leader in that she really believed that leaders came out of the community. She has a really famous quote saying that the movement made Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King didn't make the movement. I mean, she's that type of leader. So in the spirit of saying, hey, the work is going to come out of the community, we created this Baker and Supper series, and we bring a small group of Black change makers working in urban spaces together around a table of supper, and we discussed a deeper dialogue, all these, such as what we're talking about, all our experiences, and we provide a safe space for us change makers to discuss our experiences and issues and get advice. It's also an act of care. Is also an act of saying thank you to our change makers who are doing this work. So, you know, we just ask you to come, bring your openness and your spirit, and we will feed you nicely as a way to say thank you and to care for you. But really, too, we want you to leave. We want we want attendees to leave with collaboration ideas that we can call upon in the future. By the end of this year, we will begin forming opportunities for attendees of Baker and Suppers to work across cities and provide funding for them to have collaborative events and projects together. The attendees who come to Baker and Suppers, a curated event, we target just a great range of Black change makers to come to this series. So in the end, we want to have a Baker and Supper in every city all over the world. We plan to have our first international Baker and Supper at the end of the year outside of the country. And then again, following year, we start providing the funding, the opportunities for collaborations between cohorts and between people who attended the Baker and Suppers in different cities. So that's really a core of our programming for providing this network.
So the Baker and Supper series are coming to Newark.
We're coming to Newark. We are super excited.
So can you just say a little bit more about, your experience, your introduction to Newark, and why you
Absolutely.
Felt like this was an important time to have something like this here in the city?
Sure, great. So one, I'm a lover of Black cities. Black spaces are the culture, the activities, the inventions that come out of Black people on American soil, I just find absolutely riveting, right? And also, this is the work that we're doing with Urban National. We're trying to make our cities equitable. We're forcing our governments to make these systems just. That's what we're here to do. So we already had Baker and Suppers in New York City, and I always knew we was going to cross the border. Always knew, we was going to other cities. But which city? Still trying to fill out. I was a part of the Next City Vanguard conference that happened in Newark, and we got to come here to the conference, do some case studies, and I learned more. I mean, of course, I always knew about Newark being from Brooklyn. I think it's, well, hold on. I hear that people from Newark don't like Brooklyn comparisons. That's what I've heard. When I come to Newark, I'm like, oh my God, this feels like my Brooklyn growing up. And they're like, don't say that. We hate when Brooklyn people say that.
No, it's funny because one of my brothers who I love, that's why I'm an honorary Brooklynite, Zaki Smith, he was like, yo, this reminds me so much of the 80s
yes!
and the 90s on the Ave. On the Ave.
Yes!
Word B is crazy. he be doing all that. I think it's just the fear of the development.
Mm-hmm.
I think mm-hmm. at least that's what come up for me personally. I don't want to speak for every Norker, but thinking about much Brooklyn has been developed since and how it looks nothing like it used to, I think sometimes that comes up for Norkers too. Like, oh wait, we don't want to be on that same slate of Brooklyn. You know
and you
what
don't
I'm saying?
A truck of Brooklynites come and move because we will.
I know
we will migrate. But
there's a lot of folks here though. I work with young people, so I have over the past 3 years, mm-hmm. there's been like an uptick on young people coming in from Harlem, mm-hmm. Queens, the Bronx,
Absolutely.
Brooklyn.
I think this is a special spot. Again, if you are generationally New York or Brooklyn, and more specifically coming out of Black communities, we've lost pretty much easily over 50%. I mean, And so, you know, as a form of nostalgia, when I see places, I'd say Newark, one of the things that we don't see in Brooklyn as much is the just the black working class homeowners. So that is definitely something that I, you know, was just very nostalgic about. So I'm just, Newark has the spirit, right? Newark has the spirit of all the things that we're trying to progress for Urban National, right? So black, the Black Power movement influences a stop on the Underground Railroad. I mean, even what's coming out of Newark, I mean, just Newark made sense, right? I had a friend who also attended the conference with me in Newark, where I learned a lot about Newark, but I met someone, Isaiah Little, who was just, he hit me up and was like, Clarissa, Baker and Supper needs to be in Newark. And I was like, say no more. That totally makes sense. So we started working on it, and we are so excited about what's going to happen. Zay is a co-host. Urban National is bringing the Baker and Supper. This will be, it's a special one. It's our first one across New York City borders. So, I mean, just, again, makes sense. We have such a great group of people coming, a full table. And I just know it's going to be a dynamic exchange. And I'm absolutely looking forward to it.
What would you want Black change makers to know, or any change makers who might come from a marginalized group, who might not relate to their work as activism? Mm. What would you want them to know about the work that they're doing?
One, I would want them to claim it. I find that it's not being claimed like it should. Claim it and call it what it is, and treat it the same. If you want to give it a nice name and treat it, honor it in the same way, as well as. And this is big, and why we have an Urban National. You're not alone. I'd say that is also something I hear a lot from Black change makers. Every time I run into them, or if I am inviting someone to attend a Baker and Supper, they're like, what? There's more like me? You know, because of what we said, becoming unacknowledged, no resources. You feel like you're working alone. I would say those two things. You're not alone, and claim what you do. And you are an activist, or whatever you want to call it, change maker, activist. These terms are just terms, but I mean, claim it.
So where can folks follow, support, find you?
Absolutely. You can find me. Our website is urbannationalinc.com, or you can find us on Instagram at Urban National. Feel free to just always hit me up, especially when you have an idea. And this is another thing, and I'm happy, and I think it's also in the spirit of Ella Baker. I get, like, every week I get some type of message or call, or, you know, can Urban National help me out with this? Or do you know, all the time. And that actually is how I gauge my impact. And, you know, that's how I figure if I'm doing it right. We can talk, and you can feel like Urban National can help you. Let's do something. I'm always out there. If I go to events, you know how many times I go somewhere and I'm like, who's that doing that on the corner or saying something on the train? I'll stop you. And what can I do? What can Urban National do to help you? What do you need? You know, so please feel free to drop us a line. Let us even know that you exist.
And that's Urban National spelled URBANATIONAL.
Yes.
Just to be clear. Mm-hmm. Just to be clear. Well, Clarissa, thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you so much for doing the work that you do. Thank you for curating safe spaces. Thank you for understanding that representation is important, mm-hmm. and that we must create more spaces where we can see each other and also support each other. So thank you for that. And thank you for taking the time to come chat with me.
Thank you for having me. Yes. I enjoyed myself. Yes. Thank you.
Wonderful.